Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're looking into something really vital, I think. What it means, what it takes to remain faithful when the world seems set against our beliefs. We're diving into a pretty powerful message based on 1 John and 2 Timothy chapter 4.
That's right. And this deep dive is really about understanding this concept of the love that God hates. And, well, confronting the reality of increasing hostility that believers are facing globally. It's fundamentally a call to faithfulness, isn't it? Using the Apostle Paul as our anchor.
Absolutely. The source material, it starts by painting a really vivid picture of the, well, the crisis we're navigating right now.
Yeah.
It's moved beyond just, you know, simple theological differences. We're told we're in a time where basic disagreement out in the public square often blows up into genuine conflict, real division.
And the gravity of it all.
Mm-hmm.
It's reflected in some, frankly, quite jarring numbers mentioned in the source. Think about this. Since 1900, about 2.4 million Americans have died at the hands of other Americans.
Staggering.
It really is.
Yeah.
Compare that to, say, the roughly 650,000 Americans who died fighting in all our foreign wars combined. It just shows the level of internal breakdown, spiritual, societal that we're seeing.
And that kind of breakdown, well, it almost inevitably leads to hostility towards those holding on to fundamental truths, doesn't it? This rising persecution for believers. It's not some far-off theory. It's happening now.
Exactly. The material gives real-world examples. Churches being denied basic things like bank accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Pastors finding it hard to get loans. Why? Simply because of their religious affiliation.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't abstract. It's a spiritual battle. You see it in finance. You see it on college campuses. It highlights why the work of ministries like Turning Point, mentioned as having, what, 850 campus locations, why that vigilance is so needed.
And that vigilance, it seems, extends even to how we use modern tools. There was that interesting cautionary note about AI in ministry.
Right.
AI can be useful, sure, but the warning was clear. We have to be so careful that any AI-generated content stays, quote, scripturally pure.
The worry is that technology, if we're not careful, could dilute or compromise essential truth. The example given was an AI presentation on Job. Apparently, it spent most of its time on the first chapter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just glossing over the next 41 chapters of profound divine revelation. We risk swapping deep biblical substance for, well, shallow human curiosity.
So if we need to be that careful about purity in ministry, how much more careful do we need to be in our own lives?
That's the question.
And for that perspective, the message turns us to maybe the ultimate example of purity and perseverance, the end of Paul's life and ministry in 2 Timothy chapter 4.
This is Paul's swan song, as they say. It's the very last letter he wrote. He's in prison. He knows his execution, his martyrdom is coming soon. But he writes with this amazing certainty, not fear.
He talks about his life, not as something being taken, but as an offering already poured out. I am already being poured out as a drink offering, he says, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. He's looking forward, anticipating that crown of righteousness.
It's such a foundational statement of faith.
Yeah.
Here's this giant of the faith, the apostle to the Gentiles, established the church, lived this incredible life. Yet the human details of his final moments are just tragic.
It really is heartbreaking when you read it. He's a prisoner. He's asking Timothy, please bring my cloak. I'm cold. Bring my books, my parchments. He literally had nothing.
Nothing.
But the deepest tragedy wasn't the physical cold, was it? It was the betrayal he experienced.
Precisely. We learn that at his first defense, when he really needed backup, the source says not one person stood with him. Every single one forsook him.
Everyone.
But even then, Paul shows this incredible Christ-like grace. He prays that this awful betrayal would not be charged against them.
That humility, that focus, it makes the betrayal by one specific man stand out even more sharply.
Demas.
Yeah, Demas. Paul calls him out by name in 2 Timothy 4.6. States it plainly. Demas has forsaken me because he exhibits the love that God hates. He exhibits a love for the world.
And that, for anyone listening, is the core lesson here. To really feel the weight of Demas's choice, you have to understand who this guy was associated with.
It wasn't on the fringes.
Not at all. He was a close coworker. He's listed right alongside giants like Luke, the beloved physician,
yeah,
and Epaphras, who was this committed church planter, a man of fervent prayer, Mark, Aristarchus. Demas was running with the highest caliber spiritual people, men willing to suffer for Christ.
So how does someone that close to the fire just walk away? It comes down to what that phrase means, doesn't it? Love for the world.
We really need to define the world here, biblically, especially in 1 John and 2 Timothy. The Greek word is cosmos. It doesn't just mean the planet or the people on it.
Right.
It refers to the evil system, the structured, fallen way of human wisdom, ideologies, theories, philosophies, yeah. All the stuff that stands against God's kingdom.
Demas loved that system. He was maybe seduced by the comfort, the logic of the present world order. What was he really running from, though?
He was running from the cost. Paul was facing death. Martyrdom. Demas looked at that and realized sticking with Paul probably meant the same fate for him.
Mm-hmm.
The text implies he was afraid for his own safety. He wasn't willing to pay the price that discipleship sometimes demands. He bailed on Paul right when Paul was in serious need of help.
And that fear-driven choice, it puts him directly against the message's key scripture, 1 John 2.15. If anyone loves the world or the things in the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Simple as that.
Which is why James uses such incredibly strong, even shocking language in chapter 4, verse 4. James calls people who love the world adulterers and adulteresses.
Yeah, that's powerful imagery.
It's sharp, because friendship of the world is enmity with God. It means hostility towards God. God demands exclusive devotion. You just cannot serve the kingdom and the cosmos system. It's one or the other.
This helps us understand something important, I think. Why external actions aren't the whole story. You can look the part, be a co-laborer with Paul himself, walk an aisle, get baptized, and still not be the real thing deep down.
Absolutely. Demas is almost a case study for those two types of unproductive soil in Jesus' parable.
Which ones?
Well, first, the rocky ground. Remember, the seed pops up fast, looks good for a bit, but when pressure comes, persecution, suffering, tribulation, it just withers. No roots.
Okay.
Second, the weedy soil, where the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of riches choke out the gospel seed as it tries to grow. For Demas, it seems it was the deceitfulness of worldly comfort, worldly safety that choked out his calling.
The lesson there feels profoundly relevant for us today. When we choose, say, political identity first, or getting ahead in our career, or just fitting in socially, if we choose those things over the hard truths of the gospel, we are dangerously close to making the same choice Demas made.
That's the warning. The cost of following Christ is high. The world system, the cosmos, it hates the truth we carry.
It really does.
And the source reminded us, didn't it, that modern ministries, like the Turning Point example, they operate under huge pressure precisely because they profess Christ in environments that are hostile to that message, that kind of external heat. It causes many, like Demas, to just decide the price is too high.
So, okay, how do we avoid becoming a Demas? How do we stand firm? For that, we turn to Paul's crucial charge to Timothy.
Yes.
Timothy was the one Paul clearly wanted to pass the baton to, but Paul knew Timothy was struggling. He felt the heat, the hostility surrounding the early church. It was making him hesitant.
Paul saw his successor potentially wavering. He was genuinely worried Timothy might do something different, as the source puts it. Compromise the message, maybe. Retreat from the conflict. So Paul gives him these four essential commands. And they really serve as a blueprint for believers today trying to persevere.
The first command is so direct, stir up the gift of God. It's not a gentle suggestion.
No, it's active.
It implies Timothy was actually letting that spiritual gift God gave him for ministry, letting it cool down, neglecting it. Paul's telling him, fan it into flame, put it to use.
Which is a reminder for all of us, isn't it? Faith isn't passive, especially not under pressure. When the world pushes back, we can't just let our spiritual muscles weaken. We have to actively feed that fire or, well, it'll go out.
Then the second command, it hits right at Timothy's apparent struggle. Don't be a coward. And Paul immediately follows with that incredible assurance, for God has not given us a spirit of fear,
but a power and of love and of a sound mind. That phrase, a sound mind, is so important. In a world that feels chaotic, fear is irrational. It paralyzes. God gives us rational clarity, the sound mind, and the power, the Holy Spirit's power, to face opposition without caving.
Timothy needed to realize his internal resources were greater than the external pressure.
Exactly.
Okay, third command, don't be ashamed. Don't be ashamed of the Lord's testimony, and don't be ashamed of Paul, his mentor, who was now a prisoner. That takes boldness.
Right. If you believe the gospel is true, you can't hide the message. You can't hide the messenger, even when associating with them seems dangerous or embarrassing.
Being ashamed of the Lord's testimony, that means watering down the gospel, right?
Right.
Making it more palatable.
Or just keeping quiet when you should speak. And being ashamed of Paul meant distancing yourself from someone the state had labeled a criminal. for us today, it means not being ashamed of the hard doctrines, the countercultural truths, or even the sometimes inconvenient associations that come with genuinely following Christ in a secular age.
And that brings us to the fourth command. Back to the painful reality that Thomas ran from. Timothy had to be willing to suffer. Paul just lays it out there. Ministry, true ministry, involves suffering. Timothy must be willing to share with me in my sufferings for the gospel.
Paul knew Timothy was under fire, not just from outside, but likely from inside too. He mentions others, Phygellus and Hermogenes, who also turned away. The temptation to compromise, to find an easier path, must have been immense.
So how does he anchor Timothy?
With that final instruction, hold fast a pattern of sound words. Basically, cling fiercely to sound doctrine. Don't change the message, no matter how much pressure you feel from the culture around you.
Wow. So when you put the story of Demas, that tragic end, right next to this firm, loving charge Paul gives to Timothy, the takeaway seems crystal clear.
It really does.
Discipleship demands sacrifice. Mm. The world offers this seductive alternative, this comfort that ultimately leads to, well, spiritual death. We have to choose courage over comfort.
And that brings us right back to that startling imagery James uses in chapter 4, calling those who love the world adulterers and adulteresses. Mm-hmm. He's tapping into that powerful Old Testament picture of Israel. God called Israel a prostitute.
Right.
Because she committed spiritual harlotry, chasing after idols, yeah. Lifeless things like stones and trees.
That imagery, spiritual yeah. harlotry, it feels disturbingly relevant today, doesn't it? It really makes you ask the question, doesn't
yeah.
it, for you listening right now. What are the modern idols that you might be tempted to commit spiritual harlotry with? Is it human wisdom? A political ideology? Some theory or philosophy that promises security, comfort, acceptance, but ends up drawing your primary devotion away from God's kingdom?
Because seeking first the kingdom means we have to actively confront those idols, those comforts that would make us, like Demas, an enemy of God. The only way to stir up the gift, the only way to hold the line, is to make absolutely sure our primary love is for the Father, not for this present world system.
That's a profound challenge to take with us. Thank you for diving deep into these difficult but really necessary truths with us today.
Indeed. Important things to wrestle with.
Until next time, stay anchored.